I am Brian Floca, and this is my 2014 Caldecott Medal acceptance speech. I'd like to begin tonight with some numbers. Illustration and commercial art, 741.6. Public speaking and oratory, 808.51. I think you see what I'm getting at here. I don't want to question anyone's intentions, but when illustrators are asked to give banquet hall speeches, someone is showing a real willingness to misshelve. 20 years ago, I had the opportunity to illustrate a story by Avi, edited by Richard Jackson, titled City of Light, City of Dark. This was my first book. The book had a villain. The villain was, at least in his own mind, an artist. And the villain's artwork took the form of immense, garish neon signs. It makes me very happy, then, to be here with all of you tonight in Las Vegas, Nevada. Neon as far as the eye can see, and to have been brought here by the artwork in a book dedicated to Avi and edited by Dick Jackson. Locomotive is a book that took a long time to create. Some of you already know this, and some of you know it too well. The path this work took twisted and turned. Now, an interesting parallel is that the path of the Union Pacific Railroad Company, as it headed west from Omaha, Nebraska, also, at least at first, twisted and turned. The difference is that the Union Pacific was under contract to the government, and they were being paid by the mile. That is not the arrangement I had with Athenaeum Simon & Schuster. So, why the twists and why the turns? Locomotive was in many ways a book I had been waiting to make. Trains had been on and off my drafting table several times over the years. I had, after all, grown up in a town founded by a railroad company, been the proud operator of an HO-scale operation as a boy, and logged my fair share of miles on Amtrak as an adult. And yet, for a long while, the subject wasn't under my skin in the irrational, compelling way I need in order to work on a book in earnest. The essential triggering moment for the book came only when I found myself on an early morning train ride while abroad, away, importantly, from familiar sights and places. The train rolled first through darkness. Then the sun rose over a new landscape, lit a new countryside that arrived and disappeared out the window as quickly as I could take it in. That was it. There was the feeling of travel, the feeling of moving through unknown places. In this aspect of travel, we are reminded of one of the great tensions of life, the tension between the desire to stay in one place, to stay true to who we are, and the desire to leave that place and to risk becoming someone new, to become who we might be. In lightship, a crew stays put where they need to be. In moonshot, a crew leaves but returns to home and to safety. In locomotive, a family leaves and will stay away. They've left one life to make another. This may sound a little grand, and I don't kid myself that these are the things young readers see first in my books, if they see them at all. Many may not see past the noises and the gears and the smoke and the wrecks, and that's fine with me. I like all those things too, I really do, and an interest in them drives my work as well. But it's the power of landscape and travel and change that gets me started, that tells me I will stay interested through the research and work to come. Not that I truly understood how much research and work Locomotive would require when I began it. L.P. Hartley's novel, The Go-Between, opens famously, "The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there." I stepped rather innocently into that country when I decided that it might add another layer of interest to this voyage by train if I set it on the brand new Transcontinental Railroad. I quickly realized that they did a lot of things differently in 1869. It was both challenge and pleasure to try to visit that foreign country, to work to find the right ways to frame and organize what I was learning there, the right ways to make a book that could acknowledge its complexity while staying focused enough for a young audience. It was a pleasure and a challenge to try to make an accurate book that could also be a beautiful book. And how much I learned in that making, how different my impressions of 1869 are now than before I began. Many of my earlier ideas I now realize had come from the small black-and-white photographs we so often see of that period. Still images, sober images. From a still and sober time, it might seem. But instead, what a swift-moving and brightly colored time it was. What a pleasure it was to spend my time learning that, trying to think of ways to pass that sense of discovery on to young readers in words and pictures, trying to ignite in that audience a sense of how alive and real history can feel. The attempts to figure all of this out were made in books, photographs, visits to museums, conversations, on a drive across the West, even in the cabs of locomotives 150 years old. Most of the actual making of the book was done in a studio in Brooklyn, New York, like the number of the Union Pacific locomotive that pulled into Promontory Summit on May 10, 1869. The studio street address is 119. The Central Pacific engine that day in 1869, by the way, was the Jupiter. Next door to the studio, Jupiter Motorcycle Repair. You may make of this what you will, and in any case, what I like best about the studio is not the address so much as the artists with whom I share it. Sophie Blackall, Edward Hemingway, John Bevelman's Marciano, Sergio Ruzier, and John Rocco, before he cut loose for the West Coast. Writing and illustrating for young people can be a funny way to make a living, and not always funny ha-ha. While making a children's book, the things one is asked to take seriously and the things one is asked to take lightly can stand in a sort of inverse relation to the priorities of the rest of the world. Will this be beautiful? Does that mistake look good, and should I leave it there? How did these people go to the bathroom? When making a children's book, not calendars and checkbooks, but questions like these ought to be our highest concerns. For that reason and others, this work we do both offers and asks a lot. And when deadlines are coming up and when deadlines have passed and we are chasing them from the wrong direction, days in the studio can grow long. One evening last year, Sergio put on his jacket and announced casually that he was headed to his home away from home, by which he meant his apartment. Our friendships, shared experiences, and the inspiration I take from the extraordinary work being made around me are ballast through all the ups and downs of this career. Dick Jackson was not in that studio, yet he was with me every step of the way with this book. He is my first audience, and I can't imagine a better one. I rely on Dick's intelligence, taste, his sense of theater, his sense of play, his eye, his enthusiasm, and his generosity. The generosity he shows me as friend and bookmaker, and the generosity he lets me know we owe our audience. With Dick, whatever we're talking about doing for a book, it is worth the trouble. And we are not bad at making trouble. Toward the end of July 2012, I received a full-size printout of Locomotive's layout as it stood at the time. From these layouts, I stitched together a book dummy, and I read it with a sinking sense of gloom. How crowded the second half of the book had become, even though we had already bumped the book's length up from 48 to 56 pages. This was very late in the making of Locomotive, I should say, or so I thought. I figured at the time that I was about 3 months from finishing the book. Looking back on it all, I suppose I spent 2 years or more being a mere 3 months from finishing. In any case, that afternoon I sent Dick an email, telling him how the end of the book now felt to me. At 5 o'clock, he called to say that he saw what I meant and to stay tuned. Closer to 9 o'clock, the emails began to arrive, Dick letting me know he had run the bases at Athenaeum and that we could expand the book by another 8 pages. Now, you should know that Dick suggested cutting this paragraph about himself when the speech began running long, so he is not universally an expansionist. In the case of Locomotive, though, the extra room allowed cramped passages to open up again. It also made room to show a glimpse of the line's construction at the beginning of the book, a scene I had always wanted to include, but a scene that, like others, had been on and off the cutting room floor. Neither of us had to ask if the extra pages were worth the extra work. Then again, that's the other thing about working with Dick. The trouble we go to is also the fun we get to have. More pages, more work. It was one of the happiest days I had while making Locomotive. Our partner in all this was senior designer Michael McCartney. Revision after revision crossed Michael's desk, but Michael, too, is someone for whom trying to get it right is worth the trouble. Michael contributed, aided and abetted, improved, and sometimes knew where to draw the line. If you are glad the book does not take 19th century typefaces further into the realm of synesthesia and circuses, Michael's words, he is the one to thank. For a long stretch of making Locomotive, it felt as if the three of us might be making the book all on our own, operating our own skunk works, as if the rest of Athenaeum, Simon and Schuster had forgotten the book was even being made. Given where I was with my deadline, this did not strike me as impossible, and on some days the idea offered a sort of relief. When the book did begin to approach completion, I began to understand how many people there were at Athenaeum working on its behalf, making sure that Locomotive would be printed and published and publicized in a way that gave it every chance of being the book I hoped it might be. What a relief to recognize that the resounding quiet I heard had been all the while a show of trust, and what a privilege to work with a team like this. thank you to everyone who is or has been at Athenaeum who helped this book find its way here tonight. I am also grateful to friends and loved ones who have stayed close and put up with the single-mindedness that this work can compel. There is a kind of danger to this business. The work can be so consuming, can lend so much to one's identity, that one can give oneself too much over to it. I thank all of those who have alternately encouraged and tolerated the work on such days, and even occasionally pulled me out of the tunnel. In 1995, 2 years after our first book together, Avi and Dick and I reunited for the novel Poppy, which received a Boston Globe Horn Book Award. At that ceremony, Avi gave gracious thanks and also admitted to a suspicion. The notion of best, he said, may apply to sports teams and foot races, but when it comes to literature, I confess to having serious doubts as to whether any piece of writing is ever best for any one child. I remember well sitting in the audience in Manchester, New Hampshire, and thinking to myself, Avi, you just won an award. Just be happy about it. I now have the privilege of understanding Avi's remarks so much more fully. Molly Idle, Aaron Becker, and David Wiesner, it is an honor to be here with you and your books, to be here with Katie Camillo and all the Newbery Honor authors, an honor simply to be part of a field filled with so many remarkable people working to create stories worth reading, working to create art worth looking at, and working to get books into the hands of readers. The early morning call, the very early morning call that brought the good news, brought with it surprise, happiness, the sweet and unseemly thrill of victory, and a tinge of survivor's guilt. Receiving the news was relatively easy, perhaps because I was still in the middle of a sleep cycle. Sharing it with my parents without choking up was the hard part. I was glad that morning that earlier in the month I had defied a tendency toward magical thinking and, with caveats and cautions attached, forwarded a blog post to my parents that paved the way just a little bit, a blog post that asked, among other things, whether a nonfiction book like Locomotive had a shot at Caldecott recognition. My mother had replied simply, "What do they mean Locomotive might pull a snowflake Bentley?" I am grateful to my parents, to whom the idea of my making a career in the arts felt only slightly more foreign and nerve-wracking than it did to me when I began, but whose support has been one of the great constants of my life. Finally, I would like to close by acknowledging that it is librarians and the attention you bring to books that creates a space in our country for the kind of bookmaking and publishing I have tried to describe, the kind that takes its time, that goes forward in a seemingly deeply impractical way, more concerned with trying to make the best book than anything else. Your attention to our work gives such efforts a glimmer of plausibility, a thin veneer of the rational, a thread of this just might work out after all. You librarians know this already, but I want you to know that I know it too, and that I'm grateful. The recognition you have granted my efforts will help me to keep making work, and for the rest of my career, the memory of this recognition and the memory of this evening will inspire me to keep trying to make the work better. Thank you to Chair Marion Haynes Rutsch and to the members of the 2014 Caldecott Committee. Thank you to you all. I look forward to seeing you in the hallway soon, and to shaking hands until we all collapse. Again, thank you.